Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lynn Camella, Associate Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And we're talking about her latest book, Vibrator Nation: How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. Lynn, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Now, talk to me about you coming to write this history, because you actually started doing interviews for this book in 1998. So what brought you to wanting to write this history?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a book that took a number of years to write. And I think if I knew, you know, when I started it, how long a project it would, you know, grow into, I may have been too intimidated to jump in the first place. But the project started when I was in graduate school at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And at that time, I was really interested in broader questions around sexual representation and public culture. And so I became very interested in those ways in which female sexuality in particular assumes a public presence as opposed to being relegated to the home or the domestic sphere. And I knew that there were feminist sex toy shops. So it just so happened at that time, a feminist sex toy store had opened in a small college town where I was living, which was Northampton, Massachusetts. And the project started as a paper for a graduate seminar and grew from there.
And this book is about, there's so many issues involved in this book. And this is what I found fascinating. I mean, obviously, there's the history of sex positivity from a feminist perspective. But it's also the history of dedicated people coming to terms with capitalism from running a store and what that means, and also dealing with the image and the ideas of sexuality within a growing and evolving feminism. There's a lot of different threads that are in this story.
Yeah, there is, and I'm glad that you picked up on those different threads. You know, those were definitely key themes that emerged throughout my decade plus of research on this book, you know, which included, you know, over 80 in-depth interviews with feminist entrepreneurs and sex shop employees and marketers and feminist pornographers, et cetera. And I think you've pinpointed, you know, kind of two key themes that I try to, you know, tease out in the book. And one is, you know, how do feminists engage with, grapple with, attempt to come to terms with the contradictions of kind of being a feminist who's running a retail business, you know?
And that's right.
One of the themes that was so interesting to me was that a number of the women that I interviewed just hated to think of themselves as businesswomen, even though they were running stores. I mean, they just, you know, fundamentally hated it. So there was a lot that they had to personally negotiate around their own discomfort with being a quote-unquote player in the world of consumer capitalism. And then, you know, in addition to that, what did it mean to be a feminist entrepreneur whose focus was specifically on sex, particularly given feminism's fraught history with kind of the politics of sexuality when it comes to pornography and other forms of commercialized sex. And so, you know, the feminism question in regard to capitalism was one issue. The feminism question in regard to commercial versions of sexuality was the other issue. And these were not kind of easy tensions, I guess we could say, for these entrepreneurs to navigate. And in many instances, they never were able to resolve them. You know, I think some people may feel like, but, you know, these issues are never resolved. And it's like, exactly, because they still aren't resolved for a lot of these entrepreneurs. But, you know, they find a way to kind of move forward with the missions of their businesses despite the kind of discomfort and contradictions of, you know, the capitalist system.
It's interesting. The book starts back in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And you really have to be of a certain age, and I am, to realize how little information there was for women about their sexuality that mm-hmm. there was out there in the press, so that people like Betty Dodson had to have workshops on masturbation, which sounds today insane.
Yeah, right?
But it was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It sounds so out of the realm of
like, how could you not know
in 2017? And, you know, I can just imagine, you know, and I've had these conversations with my, you know, undergraduate students at UNLV around, you know, try to transport yourself back to the early 70s, right? And imagine an era where there was no internet, there was no Sex in the City, there was no, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. And, you know, just having a space, you know, like a consciousness raising group or a workshop, for example, where women could come together and talk about their sexuality with other women, was really groundbreaking and revolutionary. And certainly Betty Dodson was one of the key players in kind of pushing the sexual discourse forward, not only through her groundbreaking body sex workshops that she held in her New York City apartment, but she wrote a book, right. You know, called Liberating Masturbation, which certainly, you know, found its way into the hands of a lot of women in the early 1970s, and it was revolutionary for them to read about the kind of politics of sexuality, the politics of heterosexuality, and just have someone say, female masturbation can be a stepping stone for self-discovery. Right. And, right. You know, you should do it because you'll learn about your body. And the more you learn about the body, your body, the better you're going to be able to communicate with a partner if you're having sex with a partner. And those are easy messages to take for granted today, I think. But they were definitely groundbreaking in the early 1970s.
Now, one of the first people that started a more commercial operation was Del Williams and Eve's Garden. Mm-hmm. Talk about Del Williams. I remember Eve's Garden. I remember the advertisements.
Yeah. And Eve's Garden is still there today, still in that same office building in Midtown Manhattan, where it's been for many, many years. So Del Williams is a very, very interesting, fascinating figure. And she, kind of came to life, so to speak, when she discovered feminism and the women's liberation movement at the start of the 1970s. She was, in her early 50s, and she became involved with the National Organization for Women and became friends with Betty Dodson. So she was talking about female sexuality, reading some of these books, and going through her own process of sexual self-discovery, which included, at one point, attending one of Betty Dodson's body sex workshops. And she, you know, essentially just really felt that female sexuality had to be a core component of discussions around female liberation, that women would never be truly, truly liberated unless they kind of got a handle on their sexuality. So one of the things that was happening in the early 1970s was that women were being told by people like Betty Dodson, for example, that vibrators were a tool of liberation, that they could help many women in that process of learning about their bodies and the process of sexual self-discovery. And a lot of women were saying, great, that's wonderful. I'd love to get my hands on a vibrator, but where am I supposed to go? And so Del Williams was one of the first feminists to really step into that breach and kind of fulfill a need that a growing number of women were having, which was a desire to get their hands on vibrators, but not to have to go into stores where they would be leered at, where they would be harassed in some instances, and just made to feel really, really uncomfortable. So she started Eve's Garden in 1974, and initially it was a feminist vibrator mail order catalog, and it eventually grew into an office showroom and then a retail space. But, you know, she started that store in her early 50s, and in part because she really felt that women should be selling vibrators to other women, and just decided to roll up her sleeves and jump into the fray and figure out a way to make it happen. And it pretty bold move in 1974. And, you know, she definitely was a really key pioneer in the story that I tell about these businesses.
One of the great things about your book is you visit one of the old traditional men-oriented sex stores, mm-hmm. Which I think, is that still in Las Vegas? Was that
it
in Las
Vegas? It is.
And it was like a little time travel Mm-hmm. It went back to the 60s. And what a grim place it is. And people have to realize, women, really, it's not a comfortable place. It's not a comfortable place for a lot of men either.
Exactly.
It's just. But the thing with Dell, though, and this is a problem that comes up with the next person we're going to talk to before. Her sensibilities are primarily heterosexual, white, and professional women. And that ends up being an issue in the history that you recount. That ends up, time and again, that these early feminist sex stores are pretty narrowly focused.
Yeah. That's true. And, you know, I'm glad you raised that question. The identities of the businesses that I write about, and I write about not only Eve's Garden, but Good Vibrations,
oh, yeah,
and Babeland and Early Tibet in Chicago. And, you know, listeners might be familiar with a number of these businesses. There was one in the Boston area called Grand Opening. And now,
right,
Good Vibrations has a couple of outposts in the Boston area, one in Brooklyn and one in Harvard Square, actually. But historically speaking, a lot of the commercial identities of these businesses really evolved in and through the kind of personal and political sensibilities of the women who started them, right? And you know, in this history, the majority of these businesses have been started by white, educated, middle or middle to upper class women who had access to sources of capital that they could use as upstart money to begin their businesses. So it ended up that in some of the early businesses, such as Eve's Garden, it really was tailored around kind of how do we create an aura of like respectability around,
right,
our businesses,
right,
where even the most timid of shoppers will feel comfortable coming into our stores. But in their mind's eye, you know, that kind of idealized female consumer kind of resembled them, you know, that they were similarly white, many times heterosexual, you know, middle class, suburban housewives that, you know, maybe weren't having orgasms regularly or maybe weren't having them at all and just wanted a fun place to go on a weekend trip to the city with a girlfriend, etc. And, now it's definitely worth saying that even though a number of the kind of early entrepreneurs were primarily heterosexual women, that one of the big trends in these businesses has been the degree to which lesbian-identified and,
right,
queer-identified women have started these stores. And so increasingly, you know, there's been, you know, a real kind of opening up around, you know, sexual orientation and kind of really taking ideas of inclusivity very seriously, right? So initially these businesses were kind of especially but not exclusively for women, and now, you know, the majority of the businesses really see themselves as striving to be spaces that can be inclusive of anybody who might have an interest in learning more about sex or who might want to get their hands on a product that can enhance their sex life. So there's been this real kind of evolution and trend from kind of narrowly focused on a particular subset of women to increasingly trying to kind of expand in terms of the products they're selling, the marketing and advertising they're doing, the workshops they're doing, etc. But that idea that some of the early entrepreneurs really couldn't look past, you know, their own sensibilities when they were imagining who their stores were for is very true.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Lynn Camella, Associate Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. We're talking about her latest book, Vibrator Nation, How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. And now, Lynn, we talk about a person who I got to interview way back in the day, and she was amazing. I want to talk about Joni Blank and Good Vibrations, mm-hmm, because that store, even though it had to change over the time and went through a lot of sort of interesting issues, that still remains, when people who dealt with it, remains an icon, mm-hmm, of this. Let's talk about who is Joni Blank.
Oh, you know, Joni Blank was many things. You know, Joni Blank was a sex therapist, a sex educator, a writer of books about sexuality, and she was very significantly the founder of Good Vibrations. And so she founded Good Vibrations in San Francisco in 1977. And very similar to her predecessor on the other side of the country, Del Williams, Joni was very motivated by a desire to kind of fulfill this need that many women that she was working with in her sex therapy groups were expressing, which was, yeah, I would love to use a vibrator, but I really don't want to have to go into one of those conventional adult stores and get it. So Joni, similar to Del, decided, okay, you know, I'm going to jump into this business. And so she started Good Vibrations, which initially was a very, very tiny retail space. She decorated it with a rug that she bought at a garage sale. She had a few, you know, vibrators on display and a few books about sexuality, including some books that she had written by that point. And literally, she just kind of set up shop in San Francisco's, you know, Mission District neighborhood and waited for customers to discover, you know, this quirky little vibrator shop run by this sex therapist. And, you know, word got out and people discovered the store, and the store, you know, grew and over time hired more people and, you know, continued to go through many different iterations, you know, over the decades. But Joni Blank was really, really pivotal in creating an alternative retail model. And I talked at length about that retail model. You know, she really saw her store not in conventional retail terms, but as this kind of extension of her sex therapy in many ways, that this was a space where people could come and get accurate information about sex. This was a place where people could come and ask questions, where they could talk about sex without being judged or made to feel embarrassed or ashamed. And she really, you know, probably without thinking much about it because it was so second nature to her, brought the philosophy of sex positivity into a retail space and really did kind of create a model and create the conditions, I should add, where that model was able to travel to cities across the country because she was so willing to share what she knew with other interested entrepreneurs, you know. And so they would call her up on the phone and say, Joni, I want to open a store like Good Vibrations. And she'd say, that's awesome. Come to San Francisco. We'll train you. We'll give you everything you need. So literally, Babeland got its start in 1993, and that same year, grand opening in Boston got its start in part because Joni was so non-competitive and so willing to share information and resources that she kind of brought these quote-unquote interns in, trained them how to run a business like Good Vibrations, and then sent them back to their respective cities in Seattle and Boston with what essentially amounted to a little retail starter kit 101. Which is amazing to think about.
It is amazing.
A cutthroat world of business. Here is this, you know, really outside the box entrepreneur who hated to think of herself as a businesswoman, just basically creating the conditions where, you know, more and more people would have access to not only quality products, but importantly, spaces where they could talk about sex and where they could encounter accurate sex information. So Joni was just one of a kind. I mean, really, I mean, if you've interviewed her, you know how...
Oh, she was amazing. You immediately were comfortable talking to her. She was like your next door neighbor that you had known for a decade and you could talk to him about anything.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people had that experience with her, just very willing to share her story and very, very open. And she had great stories, amazing stories. And it's worth saying that, you know, if you know, anyone, you know, who is interested, particularly if there's any up-and-coming researchers listening to this interview, that Joni Blank's personal papers are now archived at Cornell University. They have a really amazing human sexuality collection at Cornell. And Joni died in August 2016, but it just so happened in December 2015, I spent a week with her in her co-housing living situation in Oakland, helping her arrange all organize all of her archival papers to donate to Cornell. So there's a really wonderful collection of her sex therapy work and her sex education work and, her work with Good Vibrations, those documents, papers, company memos. They're housed at Cornell now. So people who are interested in learning a little bit more about her can dive into that history through accessing those papers.
Now, the history of Good Vibrations, too, is complex also. I mean, she was the first one to create a women-centered space that women felt really comfortable in. She would do things like take the sex toys out of the boxes and put them up on the shelves so you could see directly and actually touch and feel what the products were.
Yeah.
Which is
something that I think a lot of people just simply take for granted now.
Yeah.
And, yes. If you've been to a kind of sexuality boutique or a women-friendly store.
Yeah, it's all because of her.
Yeah, it's just the way merchandising is done now. This idea that you're going to have tester models that are kind of on display.
That's right.
And that you can kind of normalize sex toys by creating the opportunity for customers to pick them up, to hold them, to feel how heavy they are, to turn them on and hold a product against their wrist or their arm to feel the strength of the vibration, because not all toys look, feel, weigh, vibrate the same way. So you can at least get some sense of how it operates. And, again, we take these kind of merchandising techniques for granted, but that was something very novel in the 1970s and the 80s to kind of break down that barrier, literally break down that barrier by taking products out of their bulky packaging, removing them from packaging that often had very scantily clad women on the outside of the packaging or very sexually suggestive imagery of some kind, and really just kind of letting the products speak for themselves, right? Like giving customers the opportunity to encounter them in a setting that had really been thoughtfully created to, ideally create a different kind of interaction with the materials that were being sold.
Now, there were several sort of within the business major sort of differences that came up over time at Good Vibrations. Mm-hmm. And one of the most fascinating ones was, she had from the start said there would be no pornography, no gimmicky novelty items and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But then as the years went by, customers came in and said, I would like X, Y, and Z. And it ended up having to push the envelope. Interestingly enough, it seemed that most of the time it was lesbian sensibility that was sort of pushing the envelope all the time. That just discussions of things like about the novel Doc and Fluff, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And that she had to sort of change her initial mission to encompass a larger idea of sexuality.
Yeah. I mean, such a good point. And I think this goes back to the question that you asked a little bit ago about the ways in which some of these stores initially took shape around the sensibility, including the sexual sensibility of the person that founded a business, right? It was kind of created in their own image, so to speak. And what that meant was, with Joni starting Good Vibrations in the 1970s, a lot of the discussion around female sexuality was centered on, educating women about the importance of the clitoris, that it wasn't all about heterosexual sexual intercourse, really challenging Freud's theory of the vaginal orgasm, etc. So vibrators were a great device that could help women discover, their body in different ways. And, so that meant, for example, that a lot of the early products were different models of vibrators. And Joni initially didn't sell dildos or, kept the dildos out of sight in a file cabinet. So it really took, staff members through the years to kind of, gently prod Joni and encourage her to kind of think outside her own sexual sensibility or comfort level. And so one early, you know, intervention was, you know, Susie Bright encouraging her to begin stocking quality silicone dildos, you know, and really telling her that, you know, this isn't about kind of, you know, reinforcing the idea of the vaginal orgasm as much as it is recognizing that there are a number of women who just really like the kind of sensation of having something inside them. And so Joni kind of got it, you know, said, oh, okay, I understand that argument. And Susie Bright was also very influential in making a case for why in the mid-1980s, Joni and Good Vibrations should think about beginning to carry erotic videos, you know, and made a similar case. Like, you might not personally like them, but, you know, there are people who really see erotic videos and pornography as any other product that they could use to kind of, you know, enhance their sex lives or be fodder for fantasies, etc. So staff really did over the years encourage Joni to expand her product inventory. But as you note, in doing that, they were also really encouraging her to expand her own ideas around sex and sexuality and, you know, kind of what women might want, right? You know, they really kind of, in some ways, pushed her, you know, into a new decade.
But this is also part of, and we're almost out of time, by the way, Lynn, that's also part of a general discussion that was going on in feminism and feminism looking at sexuality at the time is sort of expanding the ideas of what is correct or right or acceptable or whatever term you want to use. Mm-hmm. And they're, as you mentioned at the very beginning of this interview, these are discussions that aren't over, and these are discussions that are still being had. We're going to have to stop, and I have so much more that I wanted to talk to you about. My guest tonight has been Lynn Camella, Associate Professor of Gender and Sexuality Studies at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. And we've been talking about her latest book, which I found really interesting from a lot of different points of view, Vibrator Nation, How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. Lynn, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been a treat. I wish we had more time.
I know.
I know. I could have talked for, you know, another half hour.
Well, there was so much more to talk about. And I want to say that to the benefit of the audience is that there's a lot more in this book. And we could have just spent a whole show talking about capitalism and feminism, which was brought up in this book. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.